So it's wonderful to be here. I can feel the stillness when I come into this group of people. That's a stillness that you cultivate here. And that's it's a wonderful thing. We don't know how that's going to touch the world. It happens in ways beyond what we can comprehend, but I can tell you it touched my heart. So for that, I'm grateful. I really appreciate you having me here, Kokyo. This is a wonderful opportunity, and I am traveling. I live in Minnesota, and I've been making my way up the coast, and it's fun to see every group has their practice a little bit different, so it's really wonderful to meet people and see how various things are, so I can get kind of stuck in my ways. I'm sure none of you guys are like that. So, anyway, it's wonderful. But I think I'm going to jump on in to the topic at hand, Vasubandhu's Yogacara. So I wrote this book, and my buddy Busho was telling his friend about it, who's a minister, a Christian minister. And he said, yeah, my friend wrote a book. And this minister said, oh, what's it called? And Busho said, it's called Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara. And she said, I only know one of those words. So I believe I have my work cut out for me, but apparently if there's any place someone would know what I'm talking about already, this is it. Anyway, so I am going to talk a little bit just about these, the two words that are probably least familiar to the people here, Vasubandhu and Yogacara, first, and then I'll talk a little bit about the practical implications of the text that I have here. So Vasubandhu is a 5th century Indian Buddhist monk, a scholar, a writer who composed an enormous body of literature. And earlier in his life, Vasubandhu is an ancestor in all Zen lineages, and he's also considered one of the 6 ornaments of Tibetan Buddhism. So not that many people cross over between traditions in this way. Vasubandhu does. And early in his life, one of the first works he wrote was called the Abhidharma Kosha. And the Abhidharma Kosha was a compendium of all the early Buddhist, what we would now maybe consider Theravadan. There are going to be some terms here that will fly by, so don't panic. It's not going to be all terms. But anyway, so he was practicing in the early Buddhist tradition. He was not part of the Mahayana thing. We're a Mahayana thing right here. So he was in a quite different body of thought than we are, and he wrote this Abhidharma Kosha. And basically at the time, throughout India, people were like, Vasubandhu has composed the most accurate and excellent work describing what early Buddhism is to date. This is great. And that text, the Abhidharma Kosha, remains the standard text for studying early Buddhist thought in Tibetan Buddhism, where they have a heavy-duty scholastic tradition. So he wrote this thing called the Abhidharma Kosha, and then a few years later, he wrote a thing called the Abhidharma Kosha Shastra. Shastra means commentary, so he wrote a commentary on his own text. So for all you writers, just an idea. Actually, that's usually what our minds are like, a commentary on our own text. So anyway, the Abhidharma Kosha Shastra principally contained critiques of teachings in the Abhidharma Kosha. So many points where he said, this doesn't really make sense, this isn't the best way to do this, this is incoherent. So that was kind of weird, because normally when you write someone something and everyone says, you got it, you don't just go and say, no, actually, no, I didn't. This created problems because all the people who wanted to say he had it perfectly understood did not like him critiquing the teachings. So that created some difficulties. But it really says something about Vasubandhu that I value. His life continued, his thinking continued to evolve, and he continually displayed a willingness to engage in thought, which is one of the things we can do, not perhaps the most important thing a human being can do, but one of the things we can do. He engaged in thought with his whole heart and a willingness to change and learn and be transformed. And I think this is something that we can aspire to. So his thought changed quite a bit over the course of his life, and eventually the story goes, these stories are hard to know, basically anything about early Indian history is kind of murky in terms of historical factuality. But supposedly his half-brother Asanga converted him to Mahayana. And I love that because I'm like, what does that mean? You know, people ask me, when did you convert to Zen? And I go, when did I do what? I don't know. This is just something I'm doing. So anyway, he became a Mahayana teacher. So he moved away from focusing wholly on these early Buddhist teachings. And the school of Mahayana Buddhism that he became part of was called Yogacara. And I will talk about that just a little bit more. But I just want to say, so this is a person who then became one of the greatest figures in the Yogacara movement. Generally, Asanga and Basubandhu are the two main people. And you may not know anything about this, but it profoundly influenced the way people understand and practice Buddhism till today in all places. So the comparison I like to make is if Jimi Hendrix survived his addiction. This is going to make sense, I promise. If Jimi Hendrix survived his addiction and a few years down the road started composing Western classical music for orchestra, and in 500 years, people said, if you want to understand how to make really amazing popular music, Jimi Hendrix is the person to study. And if you want to study classical music, you should study Beethoven, Bach, Mozart, and Hendrix. This is the kind of transformation and the status that Vasubandhu has somehow managed to enjoy for all these years. So anyway, he began the end of his life. He was writing these works associated with the Yogacara movement. So Yogacara means yoga practice, or perhaps yoga practitioner. So it's time for sun salutations. No. Yoga means something much bigger than we understand it to mean in the United States generally. And at the bottom, the word means union or joining. It's closely etymologically related to the word yoke, like yoking oxen. So Yogacara is a movement of union or joining in many regards. Principally, it is a joining together of early Buddhist or Theravadan thought with Mahayana thought, which you may not know what they are, so too bad. For those of you who do, you may know that they're really often not all that compatible. But he, or the Yogacarans and Vasubandhu in particular, showed how they could be integrated and how they could work together, and how they're more powerful together than separate. So, And he does this. The other really distinct characteristic of Vasubandhu and Yogacara is he's not mean about it. And you might think that's obvious, but actually if you read Buddhist texts all the way back, there are denigrations of people of other viewpoints. I can think of the Buddha being quoted as saying, "You misguided man." That's like one of his little epithets for people who are really wrong. And of course, Dogen Zenji, our beloved founder, refers to the bald-pated rascals running around foolishly in China. So, and this is throughout the literature, you see this kind of language. So Yogacara tends to do this less. Vasubandhu tends to do it very little. What Vasubandhu is willing to do is make a very coherent argument about why something is not a good idea. But he doesn't do it in a way that is mean. And I value that. So maybe it is helpful to talk about bald-headed rascals. I certainly enjoy reading Dogen saying it. But to me, I think for our time, it is not a time for divisiveness. It is not a time for attacking, and it is not a time for holier than thou. So I value this aspect of Vasubandhu's teaching. So basically, the way Yogacara integrates early Buddhist thought and Mahayana thought is that early Buddhist thought is principally, though not entirely, a psychological system. It's a way of looking at working with mind, so a human being can go from being someone who suffers to someone who does not. There's a linear path, there's lots of techniques, there's stages. All the Zen people are jumping out the window because we don't have any of these stages, or, you know, we just sit. dang. See, because Mahayana thought invites us to skip waiting, going down stages, getting a lot of technique. Mahayana teachings tend to invite us to immediately jump into the fact that this is realization. And by this, I don't mean something other than this. Like, really, this is realization. So both types of teachings have their merits, but they can complement each other very well. So this is a way of bringing the psychological insight of early Buddhism into Mahayana and Zen practice. In particular, the focus here is the Yogacara says there are two principal barriers to realization. The barrier of afflictive emotion and the barrier of delusion. So the early Buddhist teachings they incorporate are all focused on alleviating painful emotional habits. And I think we can all agree that this would be beneficial. The Mahayana teachings focus on dissolving the illusion of separateness, allowing us to realize the profundity and totality of our interconnection with all things. So basically, if I was to give like the two-sentence summation of what this book that I've written is about, is inviting people to focus on being mindful of their body and emotional states and cultivating awareness of interdependence. Mindfulness of body and emotional states and cultivation of awareness of interdependence. So I do this for a couple reasons. One, I really love Zen, Soto Zen, Zen literature. But if you read the literature of Zen, you will find very little talk about emotions. You know, it's just not there very much. And the emphasis in Zen became on this cutting through delusion. That is the tendency of Mahayana thought. And that's beautiful, it's powerful, and it's wonderful, but my personal experience has been that using early Buddhist techniques that help dissolve painful emotional habits is very effective for treating people's suffering. Also, I don't know if you guys heard about this thing called like the mindfulness movement or something like that. So maybe some of you find this very distasteful. Some of you think it's great. So maybe it's the only reason you're here. I don't know. But there's no doubt that it's happening. So the mindfulness movement focuses on taking a small component of early Buddhist psychology, the practice of mindfulness, and using it for treating afflictive emotion. And it's effective, that's well documented, and it's wonderful. However, it's very limited. And the problem is we see this being used as an instrumental tool. So I get a call from a corporation. They want me to come and do a mindfulness training. I'm like, well, I would like to go. That it helps people be well. Why not? But I have to understand that part of this is just the company has seen research that shows that if they do this, they'll make more money. And this is problematic. This is problematic. So Yogacara puts everything in its teachings in a psychological framework. This would be one way of summing up what mind only means. It means we don't experience anything outside of our psychological frame. And so it allows, because it puts everything in a psychological framework and it integrates early Buddhism with Mahayana, it allows for the teachings of the Mahayana, which are about non-dualism, interdependence, altruism, freeing all beings from suffering, it allows those to be brought into the context of a psychology-based mindfulness system. So this is the other reason that I'm really interested in promoting this work of Vasubandhu. Because I think altruism, interdependence, could help us. I don't know about you guys, I've noticed there's a kind of a general feeling of fractiousness, division and separation in our country right now. Maybe you guys don't know because you're in California. I live in the district where we have like the most liberal, one of the most liberal congressmen in the country, and then right next door we have Michelle Bachmann. She's gone. I don't know if you remember her. She's not very liberal. Anyway, so we see a lot of division very close together where I am. So this union, yoga, how can we do? How can we come together? How can we heal? So I'm going to read a little passage from this book. Yogacara is closely associated with the idea of consciousness only. They're not identical terms, but they're very closely associated. So I'm going to read the opening chapter. This book is a new translation and commentary on Vasubandhu's 30 verses on consciousness only. And I will read the chapter on the first verse, which is, everything conceived as self or other occurs in the transformation of consciousness. Everything conceived as self or other occurs in the transformation of consciousness. I invite you to take a moment to investigate what you are experiencing right now. In all likelihood, you have a sense of being in a location, perhaps in a chair or a bed. There are sensations in a body that you think of as yours. There is a visual field that can be scanned from left to right. That is to say, from what you probably think of as your left and right. There are things behind you that you cannot see, but you can feel. The soft back of a chair, perhaps. Maybe that's what you're wishing right now. By the way, you feel free to move here. There are words in front of you that you conceive to be my words that you would likely say that you are reading. We can divide everything in this moment of experience into things that we conceive to be ourselves and things that we conceive to be other than ourselves, with ourselves unconsciously placed in the center. Whether we know it or not, this division and this self-centering is constantly occurring. And this division and the problems it causes and the possibility of transcending them through intimacy with them is the principal subject of the 30 verses. A brief investigation of our consciousness like the one above is likely to lead us to the idea that we have a consciousness that experiences things. Consciousness is the self, and the world around us is other. At the start of this work, Vasubandhu points towards another view. Everything conceived as self or other occurs in the transformation of consciousness. Neither the self nor the other is consciousness. They are merely conceptions occurring within a process of consciousness. The transformation of consciousness is a constant flow. If you look at experience, there are not fixed elements or even moments. There is simply a process, a transformation. The first things these verses give us is an opportunity to experience a sense of wonder about what we are experiencing right now. A sense that our most basic understanding of where and what we are in the world is not quite right. That we are instead involved in a mysterious, flowing unfolding. We see this teaching reflected in the Tibetan classic, The 37 Practices of the Bodhisattva, by Takme Sangpo in the 13th century. Quote, whatever arises in experience is your own mind. Mind itself is free of any conceptual limitations. Know that and don't generate self-other fixations. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. End quote. Consciousness only puts forth the split between subject and object as the ultimate aspect of our consciousness we must see through if we want to realize our capacity to appear in the world in a purely kind and joyful way. As we will see at the end of the 30 verses, letting go of the sense that we are self-experiencing things is the way to enter this mysterious flowing unfolding, so that whatever is here that we might call ourselves is just a natural, generous, joyful, compassionate occurrence. The Buddha called himself Tathagata, or that which is thus coming and going. He described himself as merely a flowing occurrence, and the outward form that took was constant, calm, compassionate availability to people who came to him for help. This is the way of being these verses offer to you. So the emphasis here is on consciousness itself, just this moment. So it might be an easy way to think about consciousness in this teaching is experience, the totality of what is experienced, but that doesn't quite cover it because there's some more to it, but I can't get into that today. But that kind of gives you an intuitive sense. What are we talking about? Just this thing. So now here I am talking about consciousness, and I don't know, maybe this isn't as hot a topic here as it is where I am, but when I start talking about consciousness and just facing a wall and stuff, people are really struggling right now. They're like, I think it's really important that instead of doing that, I just yell at my TV set. You know, there's something much more important for me to be doing, which is just kind of freaking out. Well, I'm being a little facetious, but I have found that a lot of the people who are really struggling to maintain their sitting as they feel a sense of cultural crisis are not that much more motivated to engage in the world. So I think you can engage in the world and do meditation too. In fact, meditation is actually an act of engagement. Well, it's hard to feel it. It's hard to feel that. So, I'm going to draw on some non-5th century Indian sources here. So, there was a kind of a slogan of second wave feminism was the personal is political. The personal is political. So I'm not here to get into politics, but the awareness that the most small parts of your personal life connect to big systems is a profoundly Buddhist one. Anyone, as you develop your sense of awareness of interdependence, you'll see that is true. So, and Bell Hooks, any Bell Hooks fans up in this place? Oh, yeah, Bell Hooks, she's cool. So Bell Hooks is an African-American feminist author with a lengthy list of wonderful books. She once wrote, "There must exist a practical model for social change that includes ways to transform consciousness that are linked to ways to transform structures." I don't know if she was reading Basubandhu. I have my doubts. But this understanding that somehow what we do moment to moment is always connected to these vast systems of transformation is what consciousness only is about. It's about letting go of this idea that we're going to fix something far away, that like some person we're never going to meet is somehow going to be changed because we just sit around and yell about what they're doing, and come back and focus on what we're doing now. As the Dhammapada says, do not give attention to what others do or fail to do. Give it to what you do or fail to do. Fundamentally consciousness-only conception. So, the first half of the 30 verses presents a model of consciousness, a way of sort of understanding how consciousness works and how to work with it to shed afflictive emotional states and cultivate beneficial ones. So the language is that you plant seeds of good intentions and they produce good results. And if you, when you plant seeds of anger, you tend to experience anger again. You might have heard some Thich Nhat Hanh. He refers extensively to Yogacara teachings. And that's where the idea of seeds comes from. So I'm going to read. So I wrote some, there's a bunch of chapters on this. So there's all these long lists of beneficial and afflictive factors. And the idea is to kind of notice when the beneficial ones are there. Go, oh, yeah, let's do this. And then you notice when the afflictive ones are there, you just are present to them and offer some beneficial energy to that afflictive feeling. Anyway, so there's some real nice chapters in here on cultivating beneficial emotions, and they're really ooby groovy. But of course, I'm going to read you the one called "Taking Care of Suffering." Hey, because you know, it's Buddhist. Come on, guys. So anyway, I'll refer in this chapter to some lists, and these are lists of these afflictive and beneficial factors, which are things like hatred, deceitfulness, guile. Yeah, I get you're guessing these are afflictive, I hope. And then you have nonviolence, energy, tranquility, carefulness. These are beneficial factors. Like some modern psychological methods, Buddhist practice sometimes encourages us to consciously draw difficult emotions into our mind and body. By allowing ourselves to experience afflictions in the light of mindfulness and our commitment to the alleviation of suffering, we can directly experience the fruits of afflictive karma and let it go. Even including this list of afflictions in this text is an example of this approach. When one reads the list, it probably takes the mind to a darker place than it was before. This list is here to help us face the difficult things that we'd like to avoid or blame on someone else. Stories actually serve, in part, this purpose of bringing afflictions into our mind. In most cultures, stories include challenges or difficulties. And when we hear them, we may experience fear, anxiety, or anger, as well as joy, tranquility, and laughter. Just look at the anxious faces of young children being told the story of Little Red Riding Hood as she sits on the bedside with the malicious and deceitful predator. How many tissues have been soaked during viewings of the movie Brokeback Mountain? We have these stories in some part because we need to know that we are not alone with our pain, that someone else is crying as the aged, fading King Lear rages at his loving, devoted daughter. Many stories from the Buddhist canon, particularly those from the Theragata, the record of the first order of nuns, tell of terrible sufferings. I vividly recall one retreat in the steep, lush hills of southern Minnesota where my teacher, Tim Burkett, told the story of the unbelievably bereft Potichara. She lost her children and entire family in a series of shocking tragedies, and she eventually made a commitment to practice and became one of the greatest teachers of her time. I wept copiously, my heart cracked wide by hours of meditation, the power of the story, and my teacher's gift for storytelling. I tasted the raw pain of her loss as my own. I saw it in my own consciousness. I left that retreat with an opened heart, a newfound knowledge of my capacity to be with my own suffering, and a deepened sense of the vastness of my connection to all of life through the bond of shared grief. Stories, of course, only go so far in helping us be well. Although they allow us to sense, generally unconsciously, that we are not alone with our pain, most of us don't attend too closely to the experience of the affliction that arises. We tend to focus on the story. In order to see the ultimate benefits of drawing into mind the difficulties of life, we need to do it in the context of our vow to end suffering and with our attention focused on actually seeing the painful states as they arise in our mind and body. We need to practice right mindfulness. So, the idea here is just to be aware of the emotional state that is here. For some people, that seems like, oh, duh. But for some other people, they're like, what? But either way, it is not a characteristic of Zen literature. It may be characteristic of the way Zen is taught here or not. I don't know. Because things change. But I recommend it. I recommend it because I think it is profoundly healing. And the truth is, it's very mysterious. If you try and practice mindfulness emotions like you practice mindfulness of breath, it's very weird. Because if we went around the room and I said, how do you feel? Everyone could say, I feel like this. But if you actually sit and try and notice your feeling as a sustained phenomenon, like your breath, it's really weird because it's quite unlocatable. So I can recommend doing this. But actually, in simpler terms, what I recommend is just frequently, throughout the day, just stop and ask yourself, as if you were the most beloved person to you, how do you feel? And then just open up to the truth of whatever is revealed. For a moment, just let yourself see that, let that feeling be known. Because otherwise, we tend to repeat the same feeling states, and we are impelled to act by them in ways we have no idea what's going on. So the basic argument of Yogacara is you can dissolve emotional patterns simply by being intimate with emotional states in their rawest sense. Most people who've done many sessions have some experience with the truth of this, because at some point you suddenly go, why am I sitting in this zendo bawling like a baby? Has your body and mind had room to reveal themselves? You're able to see it, and this is often very cathartic. So stories are good, but as I said in this chapter, they're sort of limited. And arguably, all this, the whole first section of this book, which is this complicated early Buddhist model of consciousness, is just a big old story. So being a Mahayana teacher, Vasubandhu will turn around and deconstruct the whole thing for the second half of the verses and presents a teaching which is very deconstructive. So I think I will just read about this a little bit. Yes. I will just preface this reading by saying, this, you may go, oh yeah, this makes sense. You may be going, I don't understand what the heck he's talking about. Or you may be like, heck no, that's a bad idea. Because these Mahayana teachings tend to be profoundly challenging. The Heart Sutra is no joke. Now, what are you even doing when you say, no eyes, no ears? You're like, I'm pretty sure. Chertow, who wrote the song The Grasser of Hermitage when he was a little kid, he was being taught the Heart Sutra by his preceptor, and he stopped and he said, I don't get this because I do have eyes, ears, nose, and tongue. And supposedly his preceptor said, oh, you are a student of great capacity. So who knows what we're doing here? But Mahayana teachings tend to challenge very, very basic understandings we have to get us off this narrow route that we don't even know we're on. We don't know, but you can see, we think, oh, I'm not on that narrow route. You turn on the news and you can see humankind runs down a narrow track. And you can engage in a transformation process that opens that up. So, here we go. Here, Vasubandhu begins his teachings on the Yogacara model for understanding phenomena as having three natures. The imaginary nature, the utter dependent nature, and the complete realized nature. This model of understanding is designed to enable us to realize the depth of our delusion, the completeness of our connection to all things, and the dynamism, unknowability, and liberation possible when we realize this delusion and intimacy with everything. The imaginary nature of things is our projections and beliefs. The utter dependent natures of things is their merely being manifestations of infinite conditions. The complete realized nature is beyond all dualistic views. This doctrine of the three natures has a close kinship with the more commonly known Mahayana teachings on the idea of absolute and relative natures, or the two truths doctrine. When you look at an object, or a person, or an emotion, you can see the three natures in each of these things. Using the example of a tree, for instance, we would say that a tree has many characteristics that you know and understand. It is itself distinct and separate from other things. This is its imaginary nature. The conceptual habits of your consciousness construct it. Of course, many people would agree about its nature and characteristics, for we have extremely similar conceptual conditioning. The tree also has other dependent nature. It is sunshine, seeds, air, earth, and rain. The elements upon which it depends are infinite, including every drop of rain that has ever fallen on earth, which are all connected, and your gaze as you look at it, without which it would not be the thing you perceive, and all the infinite conditions that came to create that gaze. We have not even begun to scratch the surface of the tree's dependence on other things. The complete realized nature is beyond any conceptions, although it excludes nothing. It is not the imaginary, and it is not the utter dependent, and is not other than them either. In the Song of the Grasser of Hermitage, Chertow says, the vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. The complete realized nature is vast, inconceivable. We can provisionally call it a source because without it, we could not experience the imaginary nature of things that we take to be reality. It can't be faced or turned away from. It is both beyond grasping and always right here and now. Perhaps this all seems rather heady. I mean, really, it's a tree. Look at it. Actually, just stopping and looking at a tree is a good way to allow the mind time and space to soften and open up to a sense of these three natures. To stop and look at a tree allows the mind to touch something in an intimate way and to relax the pace of trying to figure things out. This can plant a seed of presence, and someday you may see a tree in complete realization, beyond and intimate with all your ideas about it and your total connection to and interdependence with it. So, in talking about this, I find the concept that is most people find most problematic is the idea that all things that we conceptualize are imaginary, because people think, well, this people are suffering. That's not imaginary. So, I want to talk about connotations of the word imaginary. So, imaginary both can help dissolve our fixation and our freaking out about stuff. So, like, if you're late and you're in an automobile and there's no possible way you can get where you're going at the time you planned, the fact that you could get there is an imagination. You know, this is all imaginary. I'm just here in this place. So, you can, imaginary nature allows us to dissolve fixations by realizing that whatever we're coming up with, it isn't really ultimately real. We feel like it's so real sometimes. It makes us very stuck. But on the other hand, imagination is unbelievably important and powerful. So the principal reason that I call this the imaginary nature, which is my own translation with Wei Jian Tang, is that we are involved moment to moment in the act of imagining our lives. We have agency always. This is the fundamental teaching of Buddhism. The Four Noble Truths basically says there's vast suffering and every single moment you can do something about it. And that's never going to be controlling something else. It's always going to be working with your mind and taking a kind action. Now, taking a kind action may appear to have an external result, but if you put the emphasis on imagining what you can do and taking that step, you're empowered. And I would like to say that Martin Luther King did not get up on the National Mall and say, I have an idea. He said, I have a dream. We're not going to get out of this mess with a couple little ideas. We need people who can dream about a new possibility. Imagining. The interdependent nature, if we begin to sense this, you can cultivate a sense of the interdependent nature just by listing things depend on. It's fun. It's like a game. You know? You'd be like, I'm Thich Nhat Hanh today. It's cool. Just go to the store and make a list. You're buying something. You say, what? How many things does this depend on? Just start making a list. This will change the way you view the world. And back to Dr. King, when he was sitting in Birmingham jail, he wrote, I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham, for injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Here's a person who understood the interdependent nature of things. Maybe not perfectly. None of us is going to get it perfect. But there's so much possibility. As to the complete realized nature, this is the hardest to talk about, but this is complete. We see, or we try and remember that this is complete. That moment where you've fallen down again and done something harmful and it's still the world coming together in completeness. You remain Buddha. And when you're facing someone and they're so wrong and you hate them and feel so separate, realize that your feeling, the sense of alienation, all of it is completeness arriving. So finally, I'll just give one more quotation from a modern source, from a woman who devoted her life towards Liberation. And she's most famous for Just Sitting Down, which I think for Zen people is pretty cool. Her name is Rosa Parks. And she once said, "I wish to be remembered as someone who wanted to be free so that others would also be free." Personal is political. Our practice, every single moment affects everything and is a precious, astonishing opportunity. Thank you. So, thank you for allowing me to make many, many words in this room and offer presence. I wonder if anyone here would like to use their voice to make the sounds of questions, comments, or poems.
Thank you, Ben. You have me with Brokeback Mountain. you talk about in the book about the practice of those beneficial factors. It really cultivates the capacity of the mind to really abide or dwell in intimacy and non-separation. So, I mean, it's a nice sentence that really links the classical Buddhist teachings, you know, with this, you know, very inconceivable, you know, no separation, unity, and intimacy. Can you say that again?
Well, I don't know exactly what it was, but I will just list the beneficial factors just for kicks: faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire, aversion, and delusion, energy, tranquility, carefulness, equanimity, and nonviolence. Repeat them back. So these are... Someone really pointed this out to me, actually, in this situation just last week, is these have a very cool flavor. They're not like joy, love, passion. They're very quiet. So the thing is, when it's wonderful. Our minds can be very, have a lot of wonderful energy, but these kinds of beneficial factors, they're kind of like a quiet joyfulness to them. And the thing is, don't you just know from experience, the more wound up you are, especially in negative thoughts, the more alienated you feel? The more angry you get from someone, the further you feel from them. We see this the most with people in our family. Mm-hmm. You go from a brief disagreement, so it gets heated, and then it's just, you feel like you're a million miles away from someone you want to be close to. This is the fundamental condition that produces samsara. Mm-hmm. So by producing these beneficial states like tranquility, energy, nonviolence, they soften the emotional tone of our experience and they make room for us to access our intimacy.
Do you have any tips for how to live with intention without wearing like a brown thing and like living in a monastery?
Yeah, I don't think you need brown things, that's for sure. You can cultivate intention by looking into your own heart. It has to come from you at the bottom. But we cultivate and refine our intentionality with other people. So you get around people who inspire you and let that intentionality transform over time. So, you know, stop, take time to actually go, what am I doing today? Like, I just pray. Pray for a couple minutes a day. I'm like, may I be kind, may I speak kindly, may I think kind thoughts, may I be an empty place where love may freely occur, and I just make stuff up. But I cultivate my own intentionality just by speaking. And then, I get support from other people. And then I just get used to the fact that I fall down all the time, because I'm human. Oh, I don't know if that's a helpful answer, but I'm doing my best. Thank you.
How do you kindly pick yourself up?
Well, if I notice, like, for example, that my mind is attacking myself, I try and be present. Oh, try and be present to the thought, and offer that nonviolent attention. And then I notice the feeling. Oh, it's shame. Well, at this point, I can experience shame without any thinking. Lucky me. Actually, we all do. It's under there, but you know, sometimes. So it's in the body. So then I offer attention to the emotional state in the body. So that's the best way. I mean, I don't succeed at doing that all the time. Mm-hmm. But optimally, once I see that there's some kind of attacking going on, yeah. It doesn't matter who it's from. Me, you, mm-hmm. all is an opportunity to meet it with mm-hmm. nonviolence and compassion. Mm-hmm. Yes?
For about 15 years, I try to read Zen, my Zen books most nights, and frequently I'm struck with the fact that I knew every word in that sentence, but I have no idea what I just read, and I knew all the English in that paragraph, and I don't know where I'm, I have no idea where I am, and I just want to throw up my hand and say, okay, I quit, I'll just go sit. Any words of wisdom?
Yeah, well, just go sit is not bad. So you've got some pretty good wisdom already. A few things. There's no use engaging with literature that's not touching your consciousness or your heart in a meaningful way. I have found that really challenging texts, it's very helpful to me to engage with them with other people. So I remember when I first encountered the 30 verses on consciousness only, I was in a small study group at the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, and I distinctly remember Tim handing it out, my teacher handed it out, and I was like, I don't understand what any of this means at all. And basically we studied it together for 6 weeks, and it started to mean something to me. So I can say, one, if it's not doing anything for you, you know, you don't have to do it. Two, other people can help. Three, Buddhism is a very deep and complex, a part of it is a deep and complex intellectual tradition. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who can't read doing Buddhism, you know, and people who can read who don't do any reading. So no one has to do all this stuff. I do think there is a value to some people doing it because we're honoring these people who devoted their lives to the tradition, who brought it to us. But that doesn't have to be you. So, you know, look for stuff that actually speaks to your heart.
In the early, in the 15th century background and history of the, I can't think of the word that you were talking about.
Yogacara?
Yeah. So, were there indications in there for the deity practices that exist in Tibetan Buddhism now?
Okay, were there indications of the deity practice you see in Tibetan Buddhism in Yogacara? Mm-hmm. Probably a little tiny bit, but not much.
Yeah.
It emphasizes psychology. So sometimes Vasubandhu will talk, he'll be like, yeah, you're seeing, but he says somewhere like, people in hell see a river of pus, people in heaven see a jeweled palace. But what he's talking about is that our emotional conditioning creates how we see the world.
Yeah, yeah.
So he just brings it back into a psychological frame yet again. So it allows for you to go, yeah, deities. Sure, we can talk about those. They're within what I'm experiencing right now. But it's not an area of emphasis.
Right. However, it is an area of great imagination.
Yes.
Great imagination and visualizing yourself.
Yeah.
As that deity is just waking up the identity you have right now, or ideally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you are, you know, imagining lots of compassion or slaying the with meteor or those and so forth. But, you know, it sure introduces a whole other kind of reality.
It's true, yeah, and I have very little experience with that type of material, but I understand it to be profoundly transformative for people, though. There are many ways. They're all in mind. Yes.
So you're talking a lot about not being divisive, but I wonder if there's any places that where Yogacara is unable to resolve differences between Mahayana and Theravada traditions.
Oh Lord, I'm sure there are
explicitly, as opposed to some sort of like I don't know if such a thing. I'm just curious.
Yeah, you know, I can't pull anything out of my hat. I would say yes, I'm sure there are. And people who are critiquing Yogacara, and there's lots of texts like that, are often pointing out how it doesn't work. So what we don't know, what you may or may not know, is like people in Buddhism have been like chewing on debate-style logical reasoning for a long time. So there's lots of texts critiquing Yogacara that say, oh, that doesn't work and that doesn't work. Within Yogacara, I can't think of a good example. So, sorry. Well, maybe it's time for this gathering of human beings to transform into a slightly different form. I'm so grateful to have this opportunity to be with you. You look so beautiful. It's like tripping me out. So, I can feel your practice. That's amazing. So, thank you.